our friend. Delaney couldn't help but catch the ironic emphasis. But yes, Jack was his friend, though they didn't always see eye to eye on the issues, and he felt defensive suddenly. Well, I just thought, being a naturalist and a writer, a fine persuasive one, I'm sure, that you might oppose what's going on here. It's coming down to a vote at next Wednesday's meeting, and I'm going house to house to try to talk people out of it. Me and my wife, that is. We're both going around. I mean, isn't the gate bad enough? Isn't this supposed to be a democracy we're living in with public spaces and public access? I agree, Delaney said quickly. Couldn't agree more. The idea of a wall is completely and utterly offensive, and it's not going to be cheap, that's for sure. No, and that's what I'm emphasizing with these people. Nobody wants to see their assessment go up, right? If he'd been beaming a moment ago, Todd Sweet looked positively reverential now. It was a look Delaney knew well, a California look, composed in equal parts of candor, awe, and dazzlement, and it usually presaged the asking of a small favor or a tiny little loan. Look, Todd Sweet said finally, I wonder if I might stop by your place tonight and maybe we could write something up together, I mean. I hate to say it, but I'm no writer. Then something came over Delaney, right there in the street under the sun, a slow wash of shame and fear, a bitter, stinging chemical seepage that carried with it the recollection of the Mexican and the bushes, the stolen car, Sonny Demandia, Jim Shirley, the metro section, and all the rest. He had a vision then of all the starving hordes lined up at the border, of the criminals and gangbangers in their ghettos, of the whole world a ghetto and no end to it, and he felt the pendulum swing back at him. There would be war in his living room if he actively opposed this wall, war with his wife and with Jack and his triumvirate of Cherrystone, Shirley, and Flood. Was he willing to risk that? Did the wall really matter all that much? Todd Sweet was studying his face, the eyes harder now, more penetrating, the mask slipping. Hey, if it's too much trouble, he said. I mean, if you want to live in a walled city like something out of the Mask of the Red Death, that's your prerogative. But I just assumed... He trailed off, a thin, petulant edge to his voice. No, that's not the problem, Delaney said. Then why shouldn't he defy Kyra and Jack and stand up for what he believed in? But then he saw that phantom car again, the one with the rumbling speakers and impenetrable windows, and he hesitated. Look, he said, I'll call you. And he turned to walk away. 713-2280, Todd Sweet called at his back. But he wasn't listening, his mind gone numb with ambivalence. He went on up the block, barely registering the world spread out before him, glum, dogless, on his own. Nothing was moving. The sun was everything. And then he turned into his own street, Pignon Drive, and saw that life existed after all. Another figure was drifting across the static landscape in the blast of late summer heat. He couldn't be sure, but it seemed to be the bipedal figure of a man slipping through the heat haze like an illusion, legs scissoring the light. The man had a white cloth shoulder bag slung over one arm, Delaney saw as he came closer, and he was crossing the Cherrystone's lawn with the lingering insouciant stride of the trespasser, which is what he must have been since Delaney knew for a fact that the Cherrystones had gone to Santa Monica and wouldn't be back till 7. And then Delaney came closer still, and noticed something else, something that struck him with the force of a blow. The man was Mexican. Hey, Delaney called out, quickening his stride now. Can I help you? The man looked startled, looked guilty, caught in the act. And he just stood there on the lawn and let Delaney come up to him. And now the second surprise. Delaney knew him. He was sure he did. It took him a minute, something missing from the composite, but then, even without the baseball cap, Delaney recognized him. This was the hiker, the illegal camper, the man who'd soured the first half of one of the worst days of Delaney's life. And even then, even in that moment of recognition, the net widened suddenly. Didn't Kyra say that the man who threatened her at the DeRoss place was wearing a Padres cap turned backwards? The man just stood there, guarding his satchel. He didn't look away from Delaney's gaze, and he didn't respond. I said, "Can I help you?" "Help me?" he echoed, and his face broke into a grin. He winked an eye. "Sure," he said. "Sure, hombre, you can help me." And then, "What's happening, man?" Delaney was hot. He was uncomfortable. He was aggravated. The man stood a good 3 or 4 inches taller than he did, and he was letting Delaney know just how unimpressed he was. He was mocking him, bearding Delaney right there in his own community, right there on his own street. Camping in the state park was one thing, but this was something else altogether. And what was in that satchel, and why had he been crossing the Cherrystones lawn when the Cherrystones weren't at home? "I want to know what you're doing here," Delaney demanded, eyeing the satchel and imagining the Cherrystone silverware in there, their VCR, Zelda's jewelry. "This is private property. You don't belong here." The man looked right through him. He was bored. Delaney was nothing, a minor annoyance, a gnat buzzing round his face. "I'm talking to you," Delaney said, and before he could think, he had hold of the man's forearm, just above the wrist. The tan eyes looked down at Delaney's hand, then up into his face. There was nothing in those eyes but contempt. With a sudden, violent jerk, the man whipped his arm free, gathered himself up, and spat scornfully between Delaney's feet. "I got these flies," he said, and he was almost shouting it. Delaney was riding the crest of the moment, trembling, angry, ready for anything. The man was a thief, a liar, the stinking occupant of a stinking sleeping bag in the state forest, a trespasser, a polluter, a Mexican. "Don't give me that shit," Delaney roared. "I'm calling the police. I know what you're doing up here. I know who you are. You're not fooling anybody." Delaney looked round him for support, for a car, a child on a bike, Todd Sweet, anyone. But the street was deserted. The Mexican's expression had changed. The mocking grin was gone now, replaced by something harder, infinitely harder. "He's got a knife," Delaney thought. "A gun." And he went cold all over when the man reached into the satchel, so keyed up he was ready to spring at him, tackle him, fight to the death. But then he was staring into a flat white sheet of Xerox paper crawling with print. "Flies," the man spat at him. "I deliver these flies." Delaney took a step back, so devastated he couldn't speak. What was happening to him? What was he becoming? And the man shoved the flyer into his hand and stalked away across the lawn. He watched, stupefied, as the Mexican headed up the street, carrying his shoulders with rage and indignation, watched as he strode up to Delaney's own house and inserted a flyer in the slit between the screen door and the white wooden door frame. Then, finally, Delaney looked down at the sheet of paper in his hand. "A special message from the president of the Arroyo Blanco Estates Property Owners Association," it read in block letters across the top. And then, beneath it, "I urge all of you to attend Wednesday's meeting on an issue vital to the security and well-being of us all." 7. The first 15 minutes were nothing. America never asked herself what she was doing sitting on that concrete wall out front of the post office building in Canoga Park, never gave it a thought. She was exhausted, her feet ached, she felt hot and sleepy and a little nauseous, and she just sat there in a kind of trance and let the rich stew of the city simmer round her. It was amazing, all this life. The sidewalks weren't crowded, not in the way she'd expected, not like in the market in Cuernavaca or even Tepoztlán. But there was a steady flow of people going about their business as if it were the most natural thing in the world to live here. People were walking dogs, riding bicycles, pushing babies in strollers, carrying groceries in big paper sacks cradled to their chests. They were smoking, chatting, laughing, tilting back their heads to drink from red, white, and blue cans of Pepsi that said, "Uh-huh," on the label. As tired as she was, as tentative and unsettled, she couldn't help being fascinated by the spectacle. And by the women especially. She watched them covertly, women her own age and maybe a little older, dressed like gringas in high heels and stockings, watched to see what they were wearing and how they did their hair and makeup. There were older women, too, in rebosos and colorless dresses, niños hurtling by on skateboards, working men ambling past in groups of three or four, their eyes fixed on some distant, unattainable vision way out ahead of them in the haze of the endless boulevard. And the traffic. It wasn't like the traffic on the canyon road at all. Here it moved in a stately, slow procession from light to light, every kind of car imaginable, from lowriders to Jaguars to battered old Fords and Chevys and VW buses and tiny silver cars that flashed by like fishes schooling in the sea. After all those weeks of deprivation, those weeks when she had nothing to look at but leaves and more leaves, the city was like a movie playing before her eyes. The second 15 minutes were no problem either, though there was more of an edge to them, a hard, hot little prick of anxiety that underscored the passing of each separate 60-second interval. Where is Condi, though? Was a thought that began to intrude on her consciousness, and its variant. What's keeping him? Still, she was glad to be there, sitting on that wall, glad to be out of that nightmare of leaves, and she was content, or nearly content. The people were amusing. The cars were brilliant. If she wasn't feeling nauseous, and if her feet weren't blistered, and if she knew where she was going to sleep tonight, and if she had something to chew on, anything, a slice of bread, a cold tortilla, this waiting would be nothing. Nothing at all. There was a clock in the window of the appliance repair shop across the way, and as the big illuminated pointer began to intrude on the third quarter of the hour, she realized that her nausea had begun to feature the brief, powerful constrictions of hunger. She looked down at her feet and saw that they were swollen against the straps of her sandals, which she'd loosened twice already, and suddenly she felt so tired she wanted to lie back on the hard concrete wall and close her eyes, just for a minute. But she couldn't do that, of course. That's what bums did, street people, vagos, mendigos. Still, the thought of it, of lying back for just a minute, made her see the bed then, the promissory bed at the Chicano's aunt's house, and that made her think of Condi, though, and where was he? During the final quarter hour, a man in stained clothes appeared out of nowhere and sat beside her on the wall. He was old, with a goat's beard and eyes that jumped out at her from behind a pair of glasses held together with a piece of frayed black tape. She smelled him before she turned round and saw him there, not 12 inches from her. She'd been watching two girls in jeans and heels, with black lingerie tops and hair starched up high with spray, and suddenly the wind shifted and she thought she was back in the dump at Tijuana. The old man reeked of urine, vomit, his own shit. And his clothes, 3 or 4 shirts and a long coat and what looked to be at least 2 pairs of pants, were as saturated in natural oils as a plantain in a frying pan. He didn't look at her, didn't speak to her, though he was holding a conversation with someone only he could see, his voice falling away to nothing and then cresting like a wave, his Spanish so twisted and his dialect so odd she could only pick up snatches of a phrase here and there. He seemed to be talking to his mother, to the memory of his mother, the ghost, the faint outline of her pressed into the eidetic plate of his brain. And there was a real urgency in the garbled message he had for her. His voice went on and on. America edged away. By the time the illuminated pointer touched the hour, he was gone. Then it was the second hour, and she was lost and abandoned. The sun was setting, the sky streaked with dying light, the storefronts, trembling with a watery silver glow like puddles, stood on end all up and down the street. There were fewer people on the sidewalks now, and America no longer found them amusing or even interesting. She wanted Candido to come back, that was all. And what if he'd had an accident? What if he was hurt? What if La Migra had snatched him? For the first time since she'd sat down on that wall, the reality of her situation hit her. She had no money, knew no one, couldn't even find her way back to that miserable pile of sticks in the canyon. What if Candido never came back? What if he died of a heart attack or got hit by another car? What then? After an hour and a half had gone by and there was still no sign of him, America pushed herself up from the wall and started down the street in the direction he'd taken with the Chicano, turning to look over her shoulder every few steps to see if by some miracle he might have come back to the wall from another direction. She passed antique stores, gloomy, depthless places full of old gloomy furniture. A store that sold fish in every color swimming in water so pure it was like air. A closed and shuttered luncheonette. An auto parts store that was a hub of activity. It was here, just past the auto parts store, that she turned left following Candido's lead and found herself on a side street, but a busy one, cars hurtling by against the yellow light, springs rattling, tires squealing. She saw groups of men in the lot out back of the auto parts store, gringos and Latinos alike, the sprawl of their cars, hoods up, engines running, the music pounding from their stereos till the pavement shook with it. They hardly gave her a glance. And she was too timid, too afraid to ask them if they'd seen Candido, her husband, her lost husband, and that other man. Then there was a bookstore, a few more storefronts, and the street turned residential. It was getting dark. Street lights blinked on. The windows of the houses had begun to glow softly against the shadowy shrubs, the flowers drained of color, the bougainvillea and wisteria gone gray in the fading light. She didn't see Condi, though, anywhere. Not a trace of him. The baby moved inside her, and her stomach dipped and fluttered. All she wanted was to belong in one of those houses, any of them, even for a night. The people who lived in those houses had beds to stretch out on. They had toilets that flushed, and hot and cold running water, and most important of all, they were home, in their own private space, safe from the world. And where was Condi, though? Where was the room he'd promised her, the bed, the shower? This was shitty, really shitty, worse than her father's house, 100 times worse. She was a fool to have left, a fool to have listened to the stories, watched the movies, read the novellas, and more of a fool to ever for a second have envied the married girls in Tepoztlan whose husbands gave them so much when they came home from the north, clothes, jewelry, a new TV. That wasn't what you got. You got this. You got streets and bums and burning pee. Finally, after she'd searched even the side streets off of the side streets, she went back to the wall in front of the post office. She didn't know what had happened to Condi, though. She was afraid even to think about it. But this was where he would look for her, and she would just have to sit here and be patient, that was all. But now it was fully dark. Now it was night, and the foot traffic had begun to pick up again. Teenagers in groups, men in their 20s and 30s out on the prowl. There was no one to protect her, no one to care. All she could see was the image of those animals at the border, the half a gringo and his evil eyes and filthy, insinuating fingers, the fat white man with his fat white hands, and she withdrew into herself, dwelled there deep inside where nobody could touch her. "Hey, baby," they called when they saw her there trying to melt into the darkness. "Hey, ruca, hey, sexy, ¿quieres joder conmigo?" It was nearly midnight, and she'd nodded off. She couldn't help it, couldn't keep her eyes open a second longer, when she felt a touch at her shoulder. She woke with a start, nearly jumped out of her skin, and there he was, Condi, though. Even in the bleak half-light of the street lamp, she could see the blood on his face, slick and black and without color. It could have been oil, molasses, could have been coal tar or makeup for some fright house play in the theater, but it wasn't, and she knew it the minute she saw him. "They hit me with something," he said, his voice so pinched and hoarse she thought at first he'd been strangled. "A baseball bat, I think. Right here." He lifted a hand to his hairline and touched the place where the blood was blackest. "They got everything. Every penny." And now she saw that his shirt was torn and the cuffs of his trousers hacked away till it looked as if some animal had been chewing its way up his legs. "They got everything." She looked into his eyes in the dim subterranean glow of the street lamp and let the words sink in. There would be no bed, no shower, no dinner even. And in the future, no apartment, no shops, no restaurants, no toys and blankets and diapers for her baby. Her mind raced ahead and back again, and then she thought of the woods, of the canyon, of that shit pile of sticks, and she wanted to die. His head ached. But that was nothing new. For a while there, his eyes had been playing tricks on him. Everything doubled and doubled again. 2 walls, 2 windows, 2 street lamps, then 4 and 8 and 16, till he had to clamp his lid shut and start all over again. The world was back to a single image, at least, and that was all right. But his shoulder throbbed where he must have fallen on it. And what next? It was like getting hit by that car all over again, except that this time he had no one to blame but himself. How could he have been so stupid? That chingon had no aunt. He was as bad as any vago at the labor exchange. Worse. "This way," he kept saying. "It's just up here. My aunt's house. You'll like it, man. You'll like it." He didn't have any aunt. But there were 2 more just like him waiting in the alley. And how many mojados had they clipped in their time? They knew just where to look. Every dumb hick must have sewed his bankroll into his cuffs. Where else would it be? At the Bank of America? Under his pillow at the Ritz? It was his stinking bad luck, that was all. And now his head ached, and he had nothing left in the world, not even a decent pair of pants, and America was looking at him as if he were the lowest form of life on this earth, no sympathy in her eyes, not a trace. The first thing to do was find a gas station and have America asked to use the restroom so he could slip in and wash the blood off his face. It wasn't bad. A little headache, that was all. a headache, and a whole lot of blood. He didn't give a damn for the blood, but if the police spotted him looking like this, it would be the end of him. First the restroom, then something to eat. He hated to do this to her, to America, because this was just what he'd tried to protect her from, but they were going to have to go out back of one of the fast food places, Kentucky Fried or Taco Bell or McDonald's, and go through the trash. After that, they'd need a place to sleep, some business with shrubs around it and a little patch of lawn, some place quiet where nobody would notice them, least of all the sons of bitches roaming the streets for blood. And now he had two of them to kill, hijo de la chingada, and fuck the whole world. Okay, he said, and America wouldn't look at him. Okay now, listen to me. And she listened. Scared, angry, defeated, full of pity and hate, her heart in her mouth, no bed, no shower, no nothing. The nearest service station was 5 blocks up the street, up Sherman Way, and nobody said a word to her, with Candido at her side, his face a flag of blood, his pant legs flapping like ragged banners. The attendant was Nicaraguan, and he looked at her like she was dirt when she asked for the key to the restroom without buying anything, but she smiled and used her smallest voice, and he relented. She took advantage of the opportunity to use the commode and cushion the back strap of her sandals with toilet paper, while Candida washed the blood from his face and patted the mouth of the wound dry with paper towels. His face was pale and bristling with a vagrant's short, stiff whiskers, but his hair hid the black slash of the contusion, and when he'd finished, he looked almost presentable, but for his torn shirt and the frayed ends of his trousers and the pit under his left eye that was part of him forever now. He walked 2 steps ahead of her, and he had nothing to say, his shoulders squared up like a fighting cock's, his eyes eating up the street. The few people out at this hour, drunks mainly, gave him a wide berth. Though she was tired and shot through with despair, though her feet hurt and her stomach clenched on nothing, America didn't dare ask him where they were going or what the plan was or where they would sleep, eat, wash, live. She just followed along, numbed and vacant. And all the acid odors of the street assaulted her as if they'd been distilled just for her and her alone. They walked for blocks and blocks, heading west, then turned into a bright big boulevard to the south, and followed it eternally, past shuttered restaurants, record shops, and great hulking dimly lit malls floating like factory ships in black seas of macadam. It was very late. The leaves of the trees hung limp. There were hardly any cars at all out on the streets. Finally, just as she thought she was going to collapse, they came to another broad boulevard that looked familiar somehow, painfully familiar, though it was different now in the muted light, the sidewalks deserted, traffic dormant, every decent person home in bed. She'd never been very good with directions. Candido joked that she could get lost just going from the kitchen to the bathroom. But she knew this place, didn't she? They were crossing against the light, no cars coming in either direction, when it came to her. They were back on the canyon road, right back where they'd started, where the shade trees overhung all those pretty little unattainable houses and the yards that were thick with swing sets and tricycles. She felt her heart sink. What were they doing here? He wasn't going to make her walk all the way back up the road and down into that miserable hole tonight, was he? He couldn't. He was crazy, insane. She'd throw herself down right here on the sidewalk and die first. She was about to say something when he stopped suddenly just outside a restaurant she remembered from the morning. A little place set apart on its own paved lot with plate glass windows, a candy-striped roof, and a big illuminated red and white bucket revolving round the pole atop it. The place was closed, dark inside, but the lot on either side of it was lit up like brightest day. "You hungry?" Candido whispered. And they hadn't spoken in so long her voice sounded strange in her own ears when she said yes. Yes, she was. "Okay," he said, shooting a nervous glance up and down the street. "Follow me and be quick about it, and keep your voice down." She wasn't thinking. She was too tired to think, too depressed. There must have been some vague wonder in the back of her brain, some sort of puzzlement. Did he know someone who worked here, or was he going to lift something, supplies they delivered late at night? But it never came to the surface, and she just followed him stupidly into the harsh flood of the lights. They were in the back lot now, hidden from the street, fenced in on 3 sides. A big gray metal bin stood there just outside the rear door, and it gave off an odor that told her immediately what it was. Candido astonished her. He strode right up to the thing and threw back the lid, and he never noticed the dark, quick shadow that shot out from beneath the bin and disappeared between the slats of the fence. All at once she understood. Garbage. They were going to eat garbage. Sift through it like the basueros at the dump. Take somebody else's filthy leavings full of spit and maggots and ants. Was he crazy? Had he gone mad with the knock on his head? Even at their lowest, even in Tijuana in the dump, they'd been able to scrape together a few centavos to buy steamed corn and caldo from the street vendors. She stood there, frozen at the edge of the lot, watched in shock and disbelief as Candido leaned into the bin till his legs came up off the ground and he began to kick for balance. She could feel the outrage burning in her, fueled by all the cruel disappointments of the day, a rising, white-hot blaze of it that pushed her forward to sink her nails into his leg. "What are you doing?" she demanded, in a whisper she could barely contain. "What in the name of Jesus do you think you're doing?" His legs kicked. She heard him grunt from deep inside the bin. Somewhere out on the street, an engine roared to life, and she flinched and let go of him. What if someone caught them? She'd die of shame. "I'm not touching that shit," she hissed at the flailing legs, at his fat, floundering rear. "I'd rather starve." She moved a step closer, outraged, and the smell hit her again, mold, rot, decay, filth. She wanted to shove him into the bin and slam the lid down on him. She wanted to break things, pound her fists against the walls. "Maybe you can live like this, but not me," she said, fighting to keep her voice down. "My family's respectable, miles above the likes of you and your aunt, and my father, my father." She couldn't go on. She was breathless and weak, and she thought she was going to cry. There was a prolonged grunt from the depths of the bin, and then Candido resurfaced, feeling his way with his feet, backing out of the mouth of the dumpster like a hermit crab emerging from its shell. He turned to her with his face ironed gray under the blast of the floodlights, and she saw that his arms were spilling over with red and white striped cardboard boxes, little things like candy or cigar boxes. Grease. She smelled grease. Cooking grease. Cooking grease gone cold. "Your father," he said, holding out one of the boxes to her, "is 1,000 miles away." He looked round him quickly, that worried look on his face, tensed a moment, then relaxed. His voice softened. "Eat, mi vida," he said. "You're going to need it to keep up your strength." 8. In the east, fall came in on a gust of Canadian air, invigorating and decisive. The leaves changed. The rain fell in cold gray splinters, and the puddles developed a second skin overnight. The world was closing down, getting snug in dens and burrows, and the equinox was no casual thing. But here, in the bleached hills above Los Angeles, fall was just another aspect of the eternal summer, hotter, drier, hurled through the canyons on the breath of winds that leached all the moisture from the chaparral and brought combustible oils to the surface of every branch and twig. This was the season Delaney had the most trouble with. What was there to recommend in 100-degree temperatures, 0% humidity, and winds that forced fine grains of degraded sandstone up your nostrils every time you stepped out the door? Where was the charm in that? Other writers could celebrate the autumnal rituals of New England or the Great Smoky Mountains, watching the birds flock overhead, cutting wood for the stove, cranking up the cider press, or stalking somnolent bears through the leafless woods with the first wet scent of snow in the air. But what could Delaney do to color the dismal reality of the season here? Sure, he educated his audience about fire-dependent germination, solvent extractives in manzanita and chamise, the release of nutrients in wood ash. But what could you do with a season that anticipated not the first soft, magical, transforming blanket of snow, but the hellish, raging infernos that vaporized everything in their path and shot roiling columns of atrimental smoke 20,000 feet into the air? The winds blew, and Delaney sat at his desk and tried to make sense of them. He was still collecting material for a column on introduced species and population conflict, but the seasonal phenomena had to take precedence. How did the ground squirrels react to the drop in humidity, he wondered? Or the lizards? Maybe he could do something with the lizards, and not just the horned lizard, but all of them. The fence lizard, the western skink, the side-splotched lizard, the banded gecko. Did the winds change their behavior? Did the moisture content of their prey go down? Did they spend more time in their burrows during the heat of the day? He should have been out observing them, but the weather was getting him down. A high-pressure system had been stalled over the Great Basin for weeks now, and every day was a replica of the day before. Hot, cloudless, wind like a rope burn. He'd been out on the trails yesterday and spent most of his time applying chapstick and chasing his hat. Dust blew in his eyes. The scrub was whipped flat as if by the force of some great invisible hand. He cut his hike short and went home to sit in the air-conditioned living room, shades drawn, watching a joyless football contest between panting fat men who looked as if they'd rather be elsewhere. Still, the lizard idea was a good one, definitely worth exploring. And he got up from his desk to sift through his nature library, picking up tidbits about the six-lined racer, eats the eggs of small ground-nesting birds by crushing them with its jaws and lapping up the contents. The chuckwalla, strictly vegetarian, and the Gila monster stores fat in its tail. But then, unaccountably, he thought of vultures. They must do pretty well under these conditions. No one had written much about the turkey vulture, too pedestrian, and that might make for an unusual column. And this was their season, no doubt about it. Water sources were drying up. Things were dying. He was sitting there, lost in lizard lore and statistical analyses of disgorgement rates in nesting vultures, when the doorbell rang. A dull metallic passing of gas that hissed through the nether regions of the house like air leaking out of a balloon. He debated whether or not to answer it. This was his private time, his writing time, and he guarded it jealously. But who could it be at this hour? The mailman? FedEx? Curiosity got the better of him, and he went to the door. A man in a dirty T-shirt was standing there on the doormat, a cement mixer and two flatbed trucks piled high with cinder blocks looming behind him at the curb. He was wearing a hard hat, and his arms were bruised with tattoos. Behind him, milling around the trucks, was a crew of Mexicans. "I just wanted to tell you we'll be coming through here today," he said, "and it would be a help if you could leave the side gate open." Coming through. Delaney wasn't focusing, his head swarming with lizards and vultures. The man in the T-shirt was watching him closely. "The wall," he said. "My people are going to need access?" The wall. Of course. He should have guessed. 90% of the community was already walled in, tireless dark men out there applying stucco under conditions that would have killed anybody else. And now the last link was coming to Delaney, to his own dogless yard, hemming him in, obliterating his view, protecting him despite himself. And he'd done nothing to protest it. Nothing at all. He hadn't answered Todd Sweet's increasingly frantic telephone messages. Hadn't even gone to the decisive meeting to cast his vote. But Kyra. She'd made the wall her mission, putting all her closer's zeal into selling the thing, stuffing envelopes, making phone calls, working cheek by jowl with Jack and Erna to ensure that the sanctity of the community was preserved and that no terrestrial thing, whether it came on two legs or four, could get in without an invitation. "Sure," Delaney said. "Yeah, sure." And he walked the man around the side of the house, unlatched the gate, and propped it open with a stone he kept there for that purpose. The wind lashed the trees, and a pair of tumbleweeds, Russian thistle, actually, another unfortunate introduction, leapt across the yard and got hung up on the useless fence. A sudden gust threw a handful of dirt in Delaney's face, and he could feel the grit between his teeth. "Just be sure you shut it when you're done," he said, making a vague gesture in the direction of the pool. "We wouldn't want any of the neighborhood kids wandering in." The man gave him a cursory nod and then turned and shouted something in Spanish that set his crew in motion. Men clambered up into the trucks. Ropes flew from the load. Wheelbarrows appeared from nowhere. Delaney didn't know what to do. For a while he stood there at the gate as if welcoming them. As if he were hosting a pool party or cookout, and a procession of dark, sober men marched past him shouldering picks, shovels, trowels, sacks of stucco and concrete, their eyes fixed on the ground. But then he began to feel self-conscious, out of place, as if he were trespassing on his own property, and he turned and went back into the house, down the hallway and through the door to his office, where he sat back down at his desk and stared at full-color photographs of turkey vultures till they began to move on the page. He tried to concentrate, but he couldn't. There was a constant undercurrent of noise, unintelligible shouts, revving engines, the clank of tools, and the grinding, ceaseless scrape of the cement mixer, all of it riding on the thin, giddy bounce and thump of a boombox tuned to a Mexican station. He felt as if he were under siege. 10 minutes after he'd sat down, he was at the window, watching the transformation of his backyard. The wall was complete as far as the cherry stones next door on the right. On the other side, there were still 3 houses down at Rudy Hernandez's place, but the noose was tightening. They'd run a string along the property line weeks ago, and now the workers were digging footings right up against the 8-foot chain-link fence, which was going to have to go, he could see that. The thing was useless anyway, and every time he looked at it, he thought of Osbert and Sechevero. He and Kyra would just have to pay to tear it down, yet another expense. But that wasn't what bothered him. What really hurt? What rankled him so much he would have gone out and campaigned against the wall no matter what Jack or Kyra said, was that there was going to be no access to the hills at all. Not even a gate. Nothing. The Property Owners Association had felt the wall would be more secure if there were no breaches in it. And besides, gates cost money. But where did that leave Delaney? If he wanted to go for a stroll in the chaparral, if he wanted to investigate those lizards or the gnatcatcher or even the coyotes, he was either going to have to scale the wall or hike all the way out to the front gate and double back again, which would tend to cut down on spontaneity, that was for sure. He sat back down at his desk, got up, sat down. Wind rattled the panes, workers shouted, ranchera music danced through the interstices with a manic, tinny glee. Work was impossible. By noon, the footings were in, and the first 8-inch-high band of concrete block had begun to creep across the property line. How could he work? How could he even think of it? He was being walled in, buried alive, and there wasn't a thing he could do about it. By the time Kyra came for him to go out and help her close up the DeRoss place for the night, he was like a caged beast. He resented having to escort her out there 7 nights a week anyway, but the graffiti incident left him little choice. And here he thought of that son of a bitch with his flies, and it just stoked his mood. "I hope you're happy," he said, sliding into the seat beside her. She was all business, bright and chirpy, dressed in her property-moving vest, the Lexus, a massive property-moving tool ready to leap to life beneath her fingertips. It was dark. The wind beat at the windows. "What?" she said, all innocence. "What's that face for? Did I do something?" He looked out the window, fuming, as she put the car in gear and wheeled out the driveway and down Pinon. "The wall," he said. "It's in, or most of it anyway. It's about 1/100 of an inch from the chain link." They were on Arroyo Blanco now, Kyra giving a little wave to the moron at the front gate. This was their ritual, 6 o'clock every night while dinner waited on the stove and an already fed Jordan sat before Zelda Cherrystone's TV set. Out the gate, up the hill, and down the winding drive to the DeRoss place, out of the car, into the house, a quick look round the yard and back again. He hated it, resented it. It was a waste of his time, and how could she expect him to put a decent dinner together if he was up here every night looking for phantoms? She should drop the listing. That's what she should do. Get rid of it. Let somebody else worry about the flowers and the fish and the Mexicans and the bushes. "All right," she said, shrugging, her eyes on the road. "We'll have Al Lopez take the fence down. It's not like we need it anymore." And here was the sting of guilt, the counterattack. If we ever did. "I can't walk out of my own yard," he said. She was smiling, serene. The wind blew. Bits of chaff and the odd tumbleweed shot through the thin, luminous stream of the headlights. "In the back seat," she said. "A present for you." He turned to look. A car came up behind them and lighted his face. There was a stepladder in the back seat, a little 3-foot aluminum one, the sort of thing you might use for hanging curtains or changing the light bulb in the front hallway. It was nestled against the leather seat, and there was a red satin bow taped to the front of it. "There's your solution," she said. "Any time you want, just hoist yourself over." "Yeah, sure. And what about the ramparts and the boiling oil?" She ignored the sarcasm. She stared out at the road, her face serene and composed. Of course, she was right. If the wall had to be there, and through the tyranny of the majority it did, 127 votes for, 87 against, then he'd have to get used to it. and this was a simple expedient. He had a sudden ephemeral vision of himself perched atop the wall with his day pack, and it came to him then that the wall might not be as bad as he'd thought, if he could get over the bruise to his self-esteem. Not only would it keep burglars, rapists, graffiti artists, and coyotes out of the development, it would keep people like the Degolians out of the hills. He couldn't really see Jack and Zelda Cherrystone hoisting themselves over the wall for an evening stroll, or Doris Obst, or even Jack Jardine. Delaney would have the hills to himself, his own private nature preserve. The idea took hold of him, exhilarated him, but he couldn't admit it. Not to Kyra, not yet. "I don't want to do any hoisting," he said finally, injecting as much venom into the participle as he could. "I just want to walk, you know, like on my feet." There was no one at the DeRoss place, no muggers, no boogeymen, no realtors or buyers. Kyra walked him through the house as she did every third or fourth night, extolling its virtues as if she were trying to sell it to him, and he asked her point blank if she shouldn't consider dropping the listing. "It's been what," he said, "9 months now without so much as a nibble?" They were in the library, the leather-bound spines of 6,000 books carefully selected by a suicide, glowing softly in the light of the wall sconces, and Kyra swung round to tell him he didn't know a thing about business, especially the real estate business. "People would kill for a listing like this," she said, "literally kill for it. And with a property this unique, you sometimes have to just sit on it till the right buyer comes along, and they will, believe me. I know it. I know they will." "You sound like you're trying to convince yourself." A gust rattled the panes. The Santa Anas were in full force, and the koi pools would be clogged with litter. Kyra gave him her widest smile. Nothing could dampen her mood tonight. And she took hold of both his hands and lifted them as if they were at the very start of an elaborate dance. "Maybe I am," she said, and he let it drop. On the way home, they stopped in at Gitello's to pick up a few things, odds and ends, for the feast they were planning on Thursday, for Thanksgiving. They were having the Cherrystones and the Jardines over, as well as Kyra's sister and brother-in-law, with their three children and Kyra's mother, who was flying in from San Francisco. They'd already spent $280 at the Vons in Woodland Hills, where nearly everything was cheaper, but the list of odds and ends had grown to daunting proportions. Kyra was doing the cooking, with Delaney as sous chef and the maid Orbelina on cleanup detail, and she was planning a traditional dinner: roast turkey with chestnut dressing and giblet gravy, mashed potatoes and turnips, a cranberry compote, steamed asparagus, three California wines and two French, baked winter squash soup, and a salad of mixed field greens to start, a cheese course, a home-blended granité of grapefruit and nectarine, and a hazelnut risotto pudding and creme brulee for dessert with espresso, Viennese coffee, and Armagnac on the side. Delaney retrieved the preliminary list from the folds of his wallet as Kyra strode brusquely through the door and selected a cart. The list was formidable. They needed whipping cream, baby carrots, heavy syrup, ground mace, 5 pounds of confectioner's sugar, balsamic vinegar, celery sticks and capers, among other things, as well as an assortment of cold cuts, marinated artichoke hearts, Greek olives, and caponata for an antipasto platter she'd only just now decided on. As he followed her down the familiar aisles, watching her as she stood there examining the label on a can of smoked baby oysters or button mushrooms in their own juice, Delaney began to feel his mood lifting. There was nothing wrong, nothing at all. She was beautiful. She was his wife. He loved her. Why mope? Why brood? Why spend another angry night on the couch? The wall was there, a physical presence, undeniable, and it worked two ways, both for him and against him. And if he was clever, he could use it to his own advantage. It was Thanksgiving, and he should be thankful. He stood at Kyra's side, touching her, offering suggestions and advice, inhaling the rich, complex odor of her hair and body as she piled the cart high with bright, irresistible packages, things they needed, things they'd run out of, things they might need or never need. Here it was, cornucopian, superabundant, all the fruits of the earth gathered and packaged and displayed for their benefit, for them and them alone. He felt better just being here, so much better he could barely contain himself. How could he have let such a petty thing come between them? He watched her select a jar of piccalilli relish and bend to set it in the cart, and a wave of tenderness swept over him. Suddenly, He had his hands on her hips, and he was pulling her to him and kissing her right there beneath the Diet Pepsi banner, under the full gaze of the lights and all the other shoppers with their carts and children and bland, self-absorbed faces. And she kissed him back with enthusiasm and the promise of more to come. And then, at the checkout, he was amazed all over again. "You want your turkey?" the girl asked after she'd rung up the purchases, $106.39, and why not? The girl was dark-eyed, with a wild poof of sprayed-up hair and penciled-in eyebrows, like a worldly waif in the silent films. She was snapping gum, animated, bathing in the endless shower of all this abundance. "Turkey," Delaney said. "What turkey?" Their turkey was home in the refrigerator, 18 pounds, 4 ounces, range-fed and fresh-killed. "It's a special offer, just this week only," the girl said, her voice a breathless trill playing over the wad of pink gum Delaney could just catch a glimpse of when she opened her mouth to say special. "If your order totals over $50, you get a free 12-pound turkey, won to a customer." "But we already—" Delaney began, and Kyra cut him off. "Yes," she said, looking up from her compact. "Thank you." "Carlos," the girl sang out, shouting toward the distant fluorescent glare of the meat department at the back of the store. "Bring me another turkey, will you?" For his part, Candido Rincón didn't exactly welcome the season either. That it was hot, that the winds blew and the sweat dried from your skin almost before it had a chance to spill from the pores, was fine and good, ideal even. If only it could be sustained indefinitely, if only the sun would grace him for another 2 or 3 months. But he knew that the winds would soon blow themselves out and the sky would blacken and rot far out over the ocean and then come ashore to die. He couldn't smell the rains yet, but he knew they were coming. The days were truncated. The nights were cold. And where was his son going to be born? In a bed with a doctor looking on? Or in a hut with the rain driving down and nobody there but Candido with a pot of water and his rusty knife? None of this sat easy with him as he trudged up the rutted trail to the market. America was down below in a funk. She wouldn't leave the lean-to, no matter how much he might beg or plead. She was like a deranged person sitting there over her swollen belly, rocking back and forth and chanting to herself. She scared him. No matter what he did, no matter what he brought her, magazines, clothes, things to eat, a rattle and a pair of booties for the baby, she'd just give him the same numbed look as if she didn't recognize him, or didn't want to recognize him. It was this place, he knew it. The defeat of having to come back here, of having to live like Vagos after the promise of that day in Canoga Park, after the luncheonette and the flush toilet and all those rich things and the houses with the cars out front and the peace and security inside. She'd had a breakdown then, like nothing he'd ever seen, even on the streets of Tijuana, even in the worst and lowest places. He'd seen women in hysterics before, but this was something else altogether. This was like a fit, a spell, as if somebody had put a curse on her. She wouldn't stand up, wouldn't walk, wouldn't eat the chicken he'd found for her, perfectly good pieces of Kentucky Fried Chicken the Gabachos had thrown away untouched, and he'd had to drag her back down to their camp, fighting her all the way. Yes, they were desperate. Yes, they'd lost everything. Yes, he was a fool and a liar, and he'd failed her again. But still, they had to make the best of it, had to survive. Didn't she see that? She didn't. For the first few days, she just sat there, immobilized, catatonic. He'd leave to go out scrounging for food, for work, for the cans he found along the roadway and turned in for a handful of nickels and pennies. And when he came back, whether it was 2 hours later or 6 or 8, there she'd be, just as he'd left her, sometimes in the same pose even. She wouldn't talk to him. She refused to cook. She stopped washing her hair and her body, and within the week she stank like one of the homeless, like a wild thing, like a corpse. Her eyes gored him. He began to think he hated her. Then he met Señor Willis. It was serendipity, good luck instead of bad. He'd got work a few times over the course of the first 2 weeks after the Canoga Park idiocy, standing out front of the post office with a knot of other men, not so many now, and keeping a sharp eye out for the INS or some vigilante gabacho, defying them, yes, but what choice did he have? The labor exchange was gone. Someone had come in and planted some pepper trees, little sticks 6 or 8 feet high with a puff of foliage at the top, black plastic hose running from tree to tree like a lifeline. That was the labor exchange now, saplings in the ground and the dead blasted earth. So he stood there outside the post office and took his chances, breathing hard every time a car slowed. Was it a job or a bust? And he was there late one howling, hot, dry-as-a-bone day, 2 o'clock probably. And a sledge-hammered old Corvair pulled into the lot like some arthritic bird, and there, sitting at the wheel, was a man in the same shape as the car, an old white man with a sunken chest and turtle-meat arms, white hairs growing out of his nose and ears. He just sat there, looking at Cundy, though, out of watery old gray-blue eyes that were all distended by the lenses of his glasses, till they didn't look like eyes at all, till they looked like mouths, gasping, crazy, wide-open gray-blue mouths. He was drunk. You could see that from 20 feet away. "Eh, muchacho!" he called out of the passenger's side window, which still had the sparse teeth of broken glass sprouting from the frame, the rest a vacancy. "¿Quieres trabajar?" It was a joke. It had to be. They let the old gabachos out of the nursing home and sent them down here to taunt honest men. That's what it was. Candido was sure of it. And he felt his jaws clench with hate and anger. He didn't move a muscle, just stood there, rigid. "Muchacho," the old man said after a minute, and the wind, the tireless Santa Ana, pinched his voice till it was barely there. "¿Qué pasa? ¿Eres sordo? Are you deaf? I said, do you want to work?" The car rumbled and farted through its crippled exhaust. The wind blew. The mouths of the old man's eyes beckoned. "What the hell," Candido said to himself, "what have I got to lose?" And he made his way round the car to the driver's side window and leaned in. "What work?" he asked in Spanish. There was a bottle on the seat next to the old man, 2 bottles, one of vodka with a red label and clear liquid, the other with the same label but filled with a yellowish fluid, which Candido later learned was urine. The old man didn't smell good. When he opened his mouth to smile, there were only 3 teeth visible, 2 on the bottom and 1 on the top. "Building," the old man said. "Construction. You got a strong back, you work for me, no pissing around, $8 an hour. $8? Was he kidding? It was a joke. It had to be. "Get in the car," the old man said, and Candido went round back to the passenger side, nothing to lose, jerked open the door, it was battered shut, and slid into the seat beside the 2 capped bottles, the clear and the tinted. That was Señor Willis, and Señor Willis proved to be a surprise, a big surprise, the best surprise Candido had had since he left Tepoztlan with his 17-year-old bride. The Corvair took the canyon road at about 30 miles an hour, the front end ratcheting and swaying, the tires gasping, black smoke pouring so thickly from the exhaust that Candido was afraid the thing was on fire. But it made the crest, and wound down into woodland hills, where Señor Willis pulled up in front of a house that was the size of 3 houses, and the bald, nervous-looking gringo who owned it came out and shook his hand. That was Señor Willis. Candido worked past dark, doing what Señor Willis told him, lifting this, pulling that, fetching a wrench, a hammer, the screw gun, and 2 boxes of tile from the trunk of the car. Señor Willis was remodeling one of the 6 bathrooms in this grand, hushed house that was like a hotel with its potted plants and rich Persian carpets and leather chairs, and Señor Willis was a genius. An old genius. A drunken genius. A worn-out, battered, and decrepit genius. But a genius all the same. He'd built hundreds of houses in his day, built whole developments, and not only in California, but in Panama, too, where he'd picked up his Spanish that was so bad it made Candido feel the way he had as a kid when the teacher would scratch her nails on the blackboard to get the attention of the class. Candido worked a full week with Señor Willis, and then the job was done and the old man disappeared, drunk for a week more. But Candido had money now. And he bought America things to try to cheer her, little delicacies from the grocery, white bread and sardines and oil, and the apartment fund began to grow again in the little plastic peanut butter jar. 2 weeks went by. There was no work. La Migra, rumor had it, had snatched 6 men from in front of the post office, and the agents were in an unmarked car, black, plain black, and not the puke green you could see a mile away. Candido stayed away for a while. He dipped into the money he'd made. America was like a stranger, and she was getting bigger by the day, so big he was afraid she'd burst, and she ate everything he could bring her, and kept wanting more. He climbed the hill, stood out front of the post office and sweated the police. And where was Señor Willis? He died, that must have been it. Sleeping in his car because his wife hounded him so much he couldn't take it, drinking out of the one bottle and pissing in the other, 76 years old with bad hips and an irregular heart, and who could survive that? He was dead, sure he was. But then, one hopeless, hot, wind-tortured afternoon, there came the Corvair, drifting down the road like a mirage, and there was Señor Willis, with one eye bruised purple and swollen shut like some artificial thing grafted to his face, a rubber joke you'd find in a novelty shop. "Hey, muchacho," he said, "we got work. Get in." 3 days this time, installing new gates with gravity feed on an old iron fence around a swimming pool, then replacing the coping. And then Señor Willis was drunk, and then there was more work, and now? Now that they had nearly $500 in the jar, there was a month's worth of work coming up, a whole big job of work, putting an addition on a young couple's living room in Tarzana. And what was wrong with that? America should jump for joy. They'd be out of here any day now, out of here and into an apartment where Señor Willis could come by and knock at the door, and Candido could come out and just get into the Corvair and not have to worry about La Migra snatching him off the street. But America wasn't jumping for joy. She wasn't jumping at all. She wasn't even moving. She was just sitting there by the moribund stream and the dwindling pool, bloated and fat and inanimate. Candido went up the hill. He was worried, always worried. But then life had its ups and downs, and this time they were on the upswing, no doubt about it. He was making plans in his head, and when he passed the big stubbed-toe rock where he'd encountered that son of a bitch of a half a gringo with a hat turned backwards on his head, he refused even to think about him. There was no work today or tomorrow either. It was a holiday, Señor Willis had told him, a 4-day weekend, and they would start in on the new project, the big job, on Monday. But what holiday was it? Thanksgiving, Señor Willis had said, el Día de las Gracias, el Thanksgiving. Well, that was all right. Candido would rather be working. He'd rather be putting his first and last month's rent down on an apartment, anywhere, and bringing his wife up out of the hole she was in. But it could wait another week at $64 a day, or at least he hoped and prayed it could. America was due soon. She looked like an unpoked sausage swelling on the grill. But he had no control over that. Sure, he'd stood out there by the post office this morning, but nobody came by. Nobody. It was like the whole canyon was suddenly deserted. And now he was coming back up the hill, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, to buy rice, stewed tomatoes in the can, a 2-quart cardboard container of milk for his wife, and maybe a beer or two, Budweiser or Pabst Blue Ribbon, in the tall, brown 1-liter bottle, for El Thanksgiving. He kept his head up on the road. La Migra wouldn't be working today, not on El Thanksgiving, the lazy, overfed, fat-assed bastards. But you could never tell. It would be just like them to pick you up when you least expected it. There wasn't a lot of traffic. More than in the morning, but still it was nothing compared to a working day. Candido crossed the road, careful, careful, made his way through the maze of shopping carts and haphazardly parked vehicles in the lot, and entered the Paisano's market, stooping to pick up a red plastic handbasket just inside the door. The place was the same as always, changeless, as familiar to him now as the market in his own village, and still there wasn't a scent of food, not even a stray odor, as if the smell of a beefsteak or a cheese or even good fresh sawdust was somehow obscene. The light was dead. The shoppers were the same as always, the same changeless, bleached-out faces, and they gave him the same naked stares of contempt and disgust. Or no, they weren't the same, not exactly. Today they were all dressed up in their finery for El Thanksgiving. Candido made his way down the canned vegetable aisle, thinking to save the beer cooler for last, so as to keep the beer cold to the last possible moment. And he would reach way in back, too, to get the maximally chilled ones. He smelled plastic wrap, pine sol, deodorant. He lingered over the beer, standing in front of the fogged-over door, comparing prices, the amber bottles backlit so that they glowed invitingly. And he was thinking, one or two? America wouldn't drink any. It was bad for the baby. And if she drank beer, she might forget how implacably and eternally angry she was and maybe even let a stray smile fall on him. No, she wouldn't drink any. and one would make him feel loose at the edges, little fingers crepitating in his brain and massaging the bad side of his face, but two would be glorious. Two would be Thanksgiving. He opened the case and let the cool air play over his face a moment, then reached into the back and selected two big 1-liter bottles of Budweiser, the king of beers. He was thinking nothing at the checkout, his face a mask, his mind back in Tepoztlan, the rocky cerros rising above the village in a glistening curtain of rain, the plants lush with it, fields high with corn, and the winter dry season just setting in, the best time in all the year. And he didn't pay any attention to the gringos in line ahead of him, the loud ones, two men already celebrating the holiday, their garish shirts open at the neck, jackets tight in the shoulders. "Turkey!" one of them shouted in his own language, and his voice was rich with amusement, with mockery. And now Candido looked up, wondering what it was all about. "The hell do we want with a turkey?" The man who'd been speaking was in his 20s, cocky, long-haired, rings leaping out of his knuckles. The other one, his companion, had 6 little hoops punched through his earlobe. "Take it, man," the second one said. "Come on, Jules, it's a goof. Take it, man. It's a turkey, a fucking turkey." They were holding up the line. Heads began to turn. Candido, who was right behind them, studied his feet. "You gonna cook it?" the first man said. "Cook it? You think it'll fit in a microwave?" "That's what I'm saying. What the fuck do we want with a fucking turkey?" And then time seemed to slow down, crystallize, hold everything suspended in that long 3 o'clock Thanksgiving moment under the dead light of the store and the sharp cat-eyed glances of the gringos. "What about this dude here? He looks like he could use a turkey. Hey, man!" And now Candido felt a finger poke at his shoulder, and he looked up and saw it all. The 2 sharp dressers, the plastic sack of groceries, the exasperated checkout girl with the poof of sprayed-up hair, and the big frozen bird, the pavo in its sheet of white skin, lying there frozen like a brick on the black conveyor belt. "You want a turkey?" Something was happening. They were asking him something, pointing at the turkey and asking him what. What did they want from him? Candido glanced round in a growing panic. Everyone in the line was watching him. "No speak English," he said. The one nearest him, the one with the hoops in his ear, burst out laughing, and then the other one, the first one, joined in. "Oh, man," the first one said. "Oh, man." And the laughter twisted in Candido like a knife. Why did they always have to do this, he thought, and his face went dark. Now the checkout girl chimed in. "I don't think we can do that, sir," she said. "It's for the customer who made the purchase. If he," and she indicated Candido with a flick of her enameled fingers, "rings up $50, he gets his turkey just like you. But if you don't want one..." "God, a turkey," the first one said, and he was giggling so hard he could barely get the words out. "What a concept!" "Hey, come on, move it, will you?" A tall black man with a knitted brow crowed from the back of the line. The man with the rings shook out his long hair, looked back at the black man, and gave him the richest smile in the world. "Yeah," he said finally, turning back to the checker. "Yeah, I want my turkey." And Candido looked away from his eyes and his leering smile, and the turkey found its way into a plastic bag. But the men didn't leave, not yet. They stood just off to the side of the checker and watched her ring up Candido's purchases with 2 frozen grins on their faces, and then, as Candido tried to ease past them, he didn't want any trouble. He didn't. Not now, not ever. The first man hefted the big frozen 12-pound turkey and dropped it into Candido's arms, and Candido had no choice but to grab the dead weight of it, rock hard and cold through to the bone, and he almost dropped his bottles of beer, his precious beer, and still he didn't understand. "Happy Thanksgiving, dude," the one with the ring said. And then the 2 of them were out the door, their long gringo legs scissoring the light, and the hot wind rushed in. Candido was dazed, and he just stood there looking at all those white faces looking at him, trying to work out the permutations of what had just happened. Then he knew, and accepted it, in the way he would have swallowed a piece of meat without cutting it up, gulping it down because it was there on the tines of the fork. He cradled the lump of the frozen bird under one arm and hurried out the door and across the lot before someone